This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, Crossover Podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What up, Mannix?
How was last week's Friday podcast? It was a good one. I listened to it.
Thank you. No, Lloyd Pierce, former Hawks coach. Really fun conversation about all things coaching in the pandemic. And then, of course, not coaching in the pandemic. He's had some time on his hands and just talked a lot about all the issues this season has presented. Great conversation with Lloyd. Really enjoyed it.
And what do you have coming up this week? Anything scheduled?
Nothing locked in just yet. Got a few possibilities, so stay tuned, people. We will have something though Friday.
You're supposed to use this opportunity, Howard, to tease stuff. Like, listeners of the Tuesday podcast want to know what's coming up on the Friday podcast. Can you, like, whet their appetite a little bit?
I mean, sometimes I just don't have it actually set yet. I mean, I could overpromise and then, let it... chips fall where they may. I've got five Hall of Famers joining me on the Friday morning
podcast.
Now,
there you go. Now we're talking.
I won't
now
even say
talking.
Which Hall just of lie. Fame. Might be, could be the Rock Hall of Fame. Could be the Basketball Hall of Fame. Could be the, like, you know, Tiddlywinks Hall of Fame.
There's a Rock Hall of Fame? Is that a thing?
Allegedly. It's in Cleveland. I've been twice. It's a little overrated.
All right. A lot we want to get into this week. We're going to talk about the awards ballots, which are out and due at the end of the week. MVP, of course, going to be a bit of a contentious vote, I'm sure. Other things as well. But as we always do, Howard, at the beginning of every show, we address one of the top topics, and we bring in somebody much smarter than us to educate us on said topic. On that note, let's bring in Bill Oram. Does a great job covering the Lakers over at The Athletic. Welcome, Bill. What's going on, man?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Glad you could be here. So, yeah, as you're preparing this podcast, it was the last couple of days, Lakers, injuries, struggles, all that. Then, you know, Sunday night comes along and Anthony Davis looks like Anthony Davis once again. And you start to wonder if the Lakers are putting it together. So I guess my first question is kind of give me like the state of the Lakers right now. Like, what are you feeling about this team as we're just a week or so away from the playoffs?
I think you have to say that they are in as good of shape right now as they possibly could be, considering the way the last couple of months have gone. And it's funny you said, you know, the way last night maybe swings opinion on it. Last night during the game, Jovan Buha, my colleague at The Athletic, sends me a text that is like, I'm back in, you know, they've looped me back in. You know, I think we were kind of all ready to sort of write this team off after they lost to the Raptors. LeBron got hurt again. They just looked like their spirit had kind of already sailed off to Cancun for the offseason. And, you know, and understandably so with the way this year has gone. And then, you know, they beat Denver on the heels of that Toronto game. Obviously then got blown out by the Clippers and had a close one in Portland. But then, you know, last night, just a really dominant, resolute win over, you know, a team that we've been talking about as one of the best teams in the league all year. And so I feel like it would be really hard to write the Lakers off at this point, even with all the questions we have, and because they have LeBron James and we haven't seen him much over the last couple of months. And so, you know, LeBron's, you know, health is going to be the wild card. You know, we saw him try to come back from the ankle once before and he couldn't do it. And so he's had another week plus off the ankle. And if he comes back and is able to play pain-free and AD is playing like he did over the last two games, obviously the monster game against the Suns, you have to look at the Lakers as a contender in the West, just because of how good their two guys are. But there are holes in this whole thing. You know, continuity's been an issue. They've had players in and out of the lineup. They haven't had a chance to really build chemistry with Drummond. LeBron's only played two games with Drummond. He and AD are still getting to know each other. You know, I think you would say that there's more evidence that the Lakers can't repeat than that they can. But the reasons that you would say they could are pretty darn good. And it's that you have LeBron and Anthony Davis and that this, you know, and that your core players, or at least your two superstars, your coach, you know, they've been through this before, that you did win the championship last year, that the bubble was completely unprecedented circumstances. So there's a lot of reason to give the Lakers at least some benefit of the doubt at this point.
I think, Bill, it's a little dangerous, historically speaking, to mention Laker postseason prospects and Cancun in the same sentence. It still might be a little sensitive there, dating back to Nick Van Exel in 1997, but we don't need to go there. Look it up, kids. Go Google it.
What year on the beat was that for you, Howard?
Good Lord, Howard.
That's where the Cancun reference comes from. If anybody's ever on Twitter see somebody say 1-2-3 Cancun, it's because Nick Van Exel reportedly, allegedly, said that in the huddle as they were getting their butts kicked in 99. I think it was in 97 in the playoffs. That was before I got on the beat, but by only a few months. So,
Howard, what was it like covering Paul Westhead's last season with the Lakers?
The reference there should have been George Mikan, if you really wanted to go for anyway. So, Bill, assuming that they're not heading off to Cancun anytime soon, the volatility of this team is what I am looking at. It's not volatility of personalities, but it's the volatile, all these variables, all the things you just listed. Schroeder's still not back yet. And given the time he's been out, that would imply that he actually has COVID, which means he may not be 100% for quite some time, even once he does return. LeBron, we got to see. He'll be back soon, reportedly. So I do think that there's some vulnerability here for sure, and we can't just assume anything. And you listed all the other reasons, chemistry, continuity, all that stuff. So it leads me to this question, though, because people still by default favor the Lakers. The Nuggets are strong, but no Jamal Murray. The Clippers, we all have a hard time believing in after last year's flop. The Suns and the Jazz kind of like just got here, the Suns in particular, and the Jazz just took this big leap. But if there's a team in that group that is going to knock off the Lakers, a Lakers team that is not full strength right now and may not get there, which team's most likely to be the one to knock them out? Assuming they face them. Forget the matchups for a minute. Let's assume they get through the play-in. and those are the teams that are the other top contenders. I'm not worried about other scenarios. Are any of those teams a bigger threat than the others?
I think there's two. I think the Lakers, would, if the Lakers had somehow stayed in five, I think they would have been able to win a series against Denver. I think they're trouble for Phoenix, but I think both the Jazz and the Clippers are a bad matchup for the Lakers and are just better than the Lakers right now. It's hard to say because we haven't seen the Lakers at their best with this current roster makeup, but the Clippers are a team that were really built to beat the Lakers. And last year they didn't give themselves the opportunity, but Kawhi and Paul George have just been an absolute monster against the Lakers. You look at the regular season matchups over the last 2 years, the Lakers have really struggled. They haven't come out favorably in those whatsoever. I think the Clippers are, I think if the path right now for the Lakers would be go through the Suns, beat the Suns in the first round, and then play the Clippers in the second round. And that is just, I wouldn't say it's a toss up. I'd give a slight edge to the Clippers just because the Clippers have been healthier this year. But to me, that is trouble for the Lakers. And then Utah has just been so good throughout the entire regular season and has, I think Gobert can guard Anthony Davis, in a way that, most teams don't have a guy who can. So I think those are the two matchups that are trouble for the Lakers. And, but if the Lakers end up at seven, get through this play-in, win the first play-in game, and then have a series against the Suns, that's the best path forward for them, for me. And then you basically have to play, conference finals level opponents the rest of the way.
Bill, what did you make of LeBron's comments about his health? This was right when he came back from the ankle injury where he said, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, like, I don't know if I'll ever be 100% again. I mean, there are some people out there that thought he was maybe self-handicapping in a way, like just setting it up that people think, oh, maybe he's not all the way back. And then when he does something great, it's another form of adversity that he's overcome. But, you've covered this guy for several years now. What was your reaction to those specific comments?
Well, I thought him saying I'll never be 100% again was, I guess I just took it differently. I took it as him talking about being 36 years old and, not being what 100% for him was at one point, that he is not ever going to be, 32 year old LeBron ever again. But I didn't really think it was with specific regard to the injury. That said, LeBron doesn't get hurt. He's the MVP of the league in a landslide this year. I mean, he was the MVP up until the moment Solomon Hill comes, flagrantly crashing into his leg. And so LeBron was playing at an exceptionally high level. And I thought he played pretty well in those two games that he came back before, he started feeling pain in that ankle as well. So, I thought that was almost a little, self-effacing in a way. So, I mean, that's actually, I think, a reasonable interpretation. The more interesting one was when he said two nights later, if I'm not 100%, then it doesn't matter where we land in the standings, which one I thought was, you know, if I'm a teammate of his, like, I don't know how I totally respond to that. But it's also, it was a sobering dose of reality from LeBron, and also entertaining the possibility that he might not be 100%. Again, you don't say that unless you think it's possible that, you know, you aren't going to be able to get there. And him introducing that level of doubt, I thought was telling, and part of why I thought we were going to be able to close the book on this Lakers season. Just it didn't seem like the belief was there. This group was going to be able to pull it all together in time for a playoff run. And you know, the messaging around the Lakers has changed so much over the last week, where, you know, they've tried to embrace the silver lining of the play-in. You know, whether it's getting some extra games in, whether it's just some certain in their seeding and being able to proceed in terms of managing their roster. They're in more upbeat attitude, obviously, after a big win like last night. But we do need to see LeBron. We need to hear where LeBron's head is at. But, and you listen to like what Anthony Davis was saying about LeBron's workouts over the last couple of days. You know, he had a comment last night where he was asked, you know, how LeBron's looked, and he just kind of chuckled. And he was like, based on what I've seen, you know, he's going to be fine, you know, that sort of thing. And so it's like, you know, he's looked good in workouts, but that's different from playing, you know, 40 minutes. And that's where he got into trouble last weekend. And I do think if LeBron gets into a situation where he has another, you know, still feels pain in his ankle, you do have to wonder if there's any chance of him actually getting pain free again this season, because it's been 10 more days. And if that's not enough, then maybe it's just something that he's not going to be able to, you know, topple this season.
So there was a lot of hand-wringing when they signed Andre Drummond, of course, after his buyout, being able to pick him up for nothing. And understandable from others about why, or this is around the league, why they might be concerned about that. But here we are, whatever it's been, 6-7 weeks, and I'm not sure there's a discernible positive impact from Drummond. Feels like it's still, you know, not a negative, but it's a work in progress. And part of that is because he hasn't spent that much time on the court with Anthony Davis and LeBron. And so it takes even longer to acclimate possibly. Where do you think they are with the Andre Drummond experiment? If we can call it that, can we definitively say he makes sense with this team and is going to be a net plus? If it's an awkward fit with Anthony Davis, are they going to have to pivot back to more of a Montrezl Harrell, Marc Gasol thing in the playoffs? You know, where are we in the Drummond saga?
It's really interesting. And after the Portland game, Frank Vogel said, you know, he's getting better game to game. You know, it's just going to take time. It's going to take time. And I'm sitting there scratching my head. You've got 5 games left in the regular season and then a play-in that could end your season. There is no time. And I think that, you know, the Drummond thing maybe would have made sense if you had continuity everywhere else. But it was this additional fly in the ointment to a season that has really been so turbulent and topsy-turvy in every other regard that, you know, and obviously the Schroeder thing isn't something you could have predicted, but you did make the decision to disrupt your starting lineup and basically bench your starting center when you knew that LeBron James and Anthony Davis were going to be out for the foreseeable future. I mean, that was a gamble by the Lakers. And I agree with you, Howard. I mean, it's tough to fully evaluate the Drummond thing because we haven't seen it with LeBron and AD over an extended period of time. But now they're going to be having to learn on the fly. And with what we have seen, I don't think you can say that Andre Drummond has made the Lakers meaningfully better. You know, the Lakers were 21-6 with Marc Gasol as the starting center. And then he contracts COVID and, you know, you start looking around at the landscape and yeah, there's an all-star center hitting the market who puts up way bigger numbers than Marc Gasol does. And I said this on my own podcast last week, but I do think that it was unfair to Marc Gasol the way this played out. And, you know, it's show business, not show friends. Thanks, Bob Sugar. But it is a situation where, you know, he comes over from Toronto. He makes a sacrifice to make the move to pursue a championship. And they tell him, we don't care about you scoring. We care about everything else you do. You know, we care about the playmaking. We care about the defense. We care about the spacing. And then Marc Gasol puts up career low numbers. I mean, he's averaging like 4 points a game, you know, not really, you know, making an impact on the stat sheet, but you watch the way the Lakers play, the way the ball moves, you know, it's completely different when he's on the floor versus any other big. And then, you know, he goes out with COVID and you start looking around and you say, oh, well, there's this guy who puts up way bigger numbers. And all of a sudden, maybe the scoring does matter in the way you view your roster because the counting stats and, you know, more tangible production from Drummond. And so, you know, Marc Gasol essentially loses his job while he's out with COVID. And then he comes back and whenever he plays, the Lakers have been better. You know, the offense has been better. you know, he's been much more aggressive. It kind of feels like he got the hint from that move where he's been looking for his own shot a lot more. And, you know, maybe there's a scenario where this ultimately ends up benefiting the Lakers and Marc Gasol, depending on the rotations going forward. You know, if Gasol takes the primary center, backup center minutes in the postseason, or like you said, if, you know, something changes with that rotation. Because, I mean, the other thing is Andre Drummond came with a promise that he was going to be a starting center. And the Lakers have been true to that. He has started every single game he played, even when he came back from that toe injury. But in the playoffs, all bets are going to be off. You know, we saw Frank Vogel get really creative with his bigs last year in the playoffs, where Dwight, JaVale, Markieff all took turns completely out of the rotation for entire series. And I don't think Frank Vogel is going to be afraid to do that again when the season is on the line.
One more for me, Bill. And in the context of Mannix opening the show by taking shots at my marketing abilities, so I'll self-promote on this one. I had a story last week, daily cover for SI, about the idea that the bond between superstars and coaches, at least at the highest level, dynasty-type teams, is kind of eroded. And a lot of that is because of LeBron and Kawhi Leonard in particular, guys who won multiple titles with different coaches in this era. And so it does lead to the question, though. This is year two with Frank Vogel. Vogel's a lower key kind of personality. This is not a Phil Jackson type or a Pat Riley or anything. But what have you seen in terms of the way that Vogel and LeBron, and maybe even Vogel and AD, have connected or created some sort of partnership, as short term as it may be, because that's the era we live in? What do we know about that? Because I think Vogel, we start talking about Coach of the Year and all these other things. I think he got obviously some run last year, but he doesn't come up that often. Every discussion about the Lakers is always going to be about LeBron first and foremost. So where is that dynamic, you think?
I think it's one with a lot of trust both ways. You know, LeBron was kind of desperate for a coach he could trust going into last season. I mean, obviously you're coming in the year two of his tenure with the Lakers. The first year was a disaster. Luke Walton gets fired. And then, you know, the presumed choice for LeBron, Ty Lue, spurns the Lakers and you know, ends up taking a job with the Clippers. And so, you know, LeBron needed Frank Vogel to work. Like that had to work for him. And so he bought in on the defensive end, which Frank made kind of the priority, and it paid off. I mean, the Lakers, you know, had a top five defense last year. They were dominant in the bubble. And so LeBron has seen, you know, Frank's system work for him. And, you know, again, before the injuries this year, the Lakers were right there. They're in the top three in the West. They were, I think they were within a game or two of the Jazz when LeBron's ankle sprain went down. So, I mean, there's been a lot of validation of what Frank Vogel has brought to the table. And Frank has just been very, I'm trying to think of the right word. He has given LeBron, he's empowered LeBron in a way that, you know, there hasn't been, like you said, you know, it's not the kind of personality where he is trying to establish a pecking order, establish that he is the man. I mean, LeBron has a ton of empowerment to dictate what the Lakers are going to do on the floor, a very collaborative sort of setup. And that's something that Rob Pelinka has insisted on with the front office. Also, he's talked about, you know, leaning on LeBron and AD when it comes to personnel decisions that the team has made. And so, you know, I think Frank has just been an extension of that with LeBron. And, you know, it is interesting. I did ask somebody as the Lakers were sliding what this season could mean for Frank, because I would never think of Frank Vogel as being on the hot seat. But you know, you start thinking, well, Jason Kidd is right there. And there was always the thought, hey, if things go sideways for Frank, maybe Jason's the guy they wanted anyway, or maybe LeBron has a preference for Jason. And, you know, if the Lakers really, you know, flame out in spectacular fashion, does that give the Lakers the cover that they would need to make Jason the coach if there was some internal, you know, preference there? And, you know, everything I've heard is, you know, there's still a huge commitment to Frank. I mean, the Lakers are now tied for number one in defensive rating, but they are, you know, still have been a top defense despite not having Anthony Davis for 30 games. So I think, you know, you look at the standings, the Lakers have obviously slid from where they were a year ago, but there's been some pretty impressive work done on the sidelines this season.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting, Bill. Like, I never thought of Vogel potentially being on the hot seat. I mean, last year I understood the will Jason Kidd take over stuff because of the dynamic there. I mean, Vogel took the job, and he didn't ask for Jason Kidd. He likes to have an ex player on his staff, always has, but you know, Jason Kidd was basically shoehorned on there with him. I mean, I guess to ask you one last thing, like to spin it forward, like if they do get beat early, does that, you think that means something for Vogel? Because as I'm thinking about this in real time, like Jason Kidd's going to be a candidate for some of the coaching openings that are out there. I mean, we've all heard kind of the Portland rumors a little bit. Will they make a run at him? I guess it's interesting to think that maybe a year after winning a championship, if these playoffs don't live up to expectations, you think there's a chance that Vogel could be, I don't want to say in trouble, but like, is that a conversation that you think people will be having?
I think it would have to be a really spectacular flameout with really visible coaching mismanagement. I think the bigger thing, and this is just by virtue of the time we live in and because of who you're coaching, I think it'd be much more be a situation where it would be, you know, you go into next season, and if things were, you know, not improving at the start of next season, where you might start hearing some chatter. I just have a really hard time seeing the Lakers moving off of Frank Vogel less than a year after winning a championship, and considering, you know, all the things that happened this year that were so far beyond his control. And by the way, the personnel decisions that he had to adjust to in terms of, you know, players coming in, Drummond, McLemore, and he had to integrate them in suboptimal conditions. I don't think he's on the hot seat now, but I do think you always have to be aware that, you know, it only ever takes one other shoe dropping. And I do suppose, if the Lakers felt like there was, this assumes that the Lakers really want Jason Kidd to be the head coach at some point, which may or may not be true. You know, that could be a factor, but I really don't see him going anywhere after this season either way.
No, I think Frank Vogel's an excellent coach. I was
agreed.
Banging that drum when they hired him right away. I mean, you talked about empowering players. He did that in Indiana. I know people said, well, that's Indiana, it's not the Lakers, but it's the same philosophy. And it worked in Indiana. It didn't work in Orlando, but there's like 9,000 other reasons it didn't work in Orlando. So everything he's done has been consistent with the success he had with the Pacers. So hopefully that gets taken into account as they move forward. Bill, we appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining us, making us smarter. And I'm going to explain to Howard after you sign off your backdrop there and tell him what Home Alone 2 actually is. And, you know, that there was another movie after the first one that took place in his home. So we'll do that.
Home Alone 2 was arguably better than Home Alone 1.
Blasphemy.
Arguably.
Blasphemy. No, stop saying arguably. Arguably is like the little caveat there you can throw out just in case. Well, we'll let you go with that. Thanks, Bill.
We'll get into it next time. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Bill. All right, Howard. So it is that time of year. Our awards ballots are due in just a few days now. And I think one of the more interesting ballots that we have is the All-NBA team. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, there are more elite centers on this year's ballot than there have probably been in several years. More candidates for All-NBA first team from the de facto center position that there have been for years. I also think there are some strong questions or interesting questions about All-NBA third team. So let's start with the center discussion. Joel Embiid, Nikola Jokic, do both of them deserve a slot on the All-NBA team, first team?
So the NBA has decided that both Embiid and Jokic are eligible at power forward, or at forward, I should say, as well as center.
Let me just stop you there, Howard. Do you agree with that? Like, do you?
No.
Okay. Tell me why that's a bad idea. Because I tend to agree with you that it is a bad idea.
Yeah. So I get this much, right? Like, first of all, I should note, it's been 3 years they've been identified as both forward and center for purposes of all NBA balloting. I didn't realize that. I don't think it came into play in previous years. But this year it's in play. This year it actually matters because Embiid and Jokic are also arguably the top two spots on the MVP in the MVP race. Those are the two guys who are leading the pack in the MVP race, Jokic and Embiid. And so it looks like, oh, well, this is a way of jamming them both on first team all NBA. No, they've both been classified as both forward and center for balloting purposes the last few years. I don't think I realized it at the time. It wouldn't have come up at the time, and I would have disagreed with it for sure, and I disagree with it now. So thank you, NBA, for giving us the flexibility. I am not going to opt into or take advantage of that flexibility when I fill this out.
Neither am I.
Of these guys have been playing power forward. Do they both have some forward skills, the ability to step away, put the ball on the floor, shoot from range? Sure. In Jokic's case, you could actually say that he's not just a center and a forward, but actually a guard since they run most of their offense through him, and he's one of the best passers in the league and one of the best assist guys in the league, but he's not a guard. He is a center. If the NBA is going to still say, two guards, two forwards, and two center, or excuse me, two guards, two forwards, and a center for each of the All-NBA teams, then you need to still honor where guys are mostly playing. When it comes to Jimmy Butler as a guard forward, I'm fine with that. Jimmy Butler handles the ball and runs the offense a ton for the Heat. He is both a guard and a forward. He's a wing. Paul George, maybe it's fudging it a little bit more, but Paul George is arguably both a guard and a forward. That's fine. But when you're taking Embiid and Jokic, who have spent no time at power forward, who never play with other centers next to them, it's ludicrous. I think the only reason to take advantage of it would be if you thought it was so important to get like Clint Capella or Bam Adebayo on it. And Bam, I think, is eligible at forward anyway. But if you really wanted to make room for an extra center on the third team, then you do that, because obviously Gobert is the third center. I'm not going to do that. So for me, it's Jokic first team All-NBA center, Embiid second team All-NBA center, and Gobert is the lock at third. And with apologies to Clint Capella and, you know, Bam Adebayo, although, as I say, Bam could be in the running for a forward spot in theory.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm going to vote Embiid at, or Jokic at one at the center, second team Embiid as the center, and then Rudy Gobert. That's about the easiest vote I think we can make.
It's the easiest of all of them. So while we're on that subject, though, I got to at least note, because I was reading this a couple hours ago, our friend Ben Golliver, who, of course, co-host of the Open Floor pod for SI and works for the Washington Post, Golliver wrote an entire column slamming the NBA for all of this nonsense, and then says he's going to put Embiid and Jokic both on the first team anyway. So
that
I don't even get. Like, come on, Ben, have a little consistency here. If you're saying the NBA is wrong to do this, then don't take advantage of it and embolden them. Like, tell them no. We will not take this option that you're giving us because it's wrong on principle.
So what's tough for you on this ballot? Because as I look at the All NBA teams, the toughest call for me, if I'm going to be consistent with center, 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 the two forward slots, I think first team for me anyway is pretty stable. You got to go with Giannis at power forward or one forward spot. I would put Julius Randle at the second All-NBA slot. More so now, I'm more confident of that choice now, given the Knicks are just rolling at the moment, than I was even a few weeks ago. And I was pretty confident in that selection. The second team, I'm probably picking both Clipper forwards, Kawhi and Paul George, for that slot. Third team All-NBA forward, though, it's kind of wide open. I mean, even Zion's now out with an injury, but I think he belongs in that forward slot. And the second one, I don't know. Like, Jason Tatum, does he belong in that spot? Does he get competition from his teammate, Jaylen Brown? I mean, it's probably, in my mind, Howard, there's probably 5, 6, 7 guys that could fit into that second team all forward slot. So as I look at that ballot, and I've been doing it like you for the last couple of days, that to me is the toughest call.
Chris, it seems to me you might have left one prominent name out of your list of forwards who are candidates for All-NBA.
We're talking about LeBron here?
Yes, we are talking about the greatest player of his generation and possibly the greatest player of all time, who you did not mention in your many forwards listed.
I did not, but... So, LeBron is... On he's on the floor, he's the best player in the game. Like, still is. Like, he's just wildly effective. And up until, like, what was it, mid-February, he was the MVP, as we talked about with Bill Orem. But has he missed too many games to be All-NBA in your mind? That's the only disqualification here. It's not like, sure, I think Tatum's better than LeBron. Like, that's idiotic. It's just, how many games is too many? I mean, he missed a chunk of games with that original ankle injury. He's now sat out. He'll probably be about a week before he's back on the floor with the Lakers. I mean, that to me is the biggest question mark here. Has he played enough games to surpass the other guys on that list for All-NBA? I mean, to anyone listening to this, LeBron is an All-NBA forward. I'm not. If he was healthy, he's All-NBA first team. Julius Randle is not better than LeBron James. None of the Clipper forwards are better than LeBron James. There just comes a point where durability, I think, becomes the one of the biggest criteria in voting for these awards.
And I generally agree with that. I did not vote for Joel Embiid at the top of the Rookie of the Year ballot a few years back, but that's because he played like, 20 games or something. He had played like a paltry amount of games. Games played do matter. They matter most to me, Chris, for certain awards more than others. especially MVP, because valuable is right in the damn title. Most valuable. And being available, playing a lot of games, playing minutes, that matters. So is LeBron off my MVP ballot because of the games missed? Yeah, he is. All NBA is a different exercise. Now, I know some people say, well, the first five guys on All NBA and the first five on the MVP ballot, that's like, that should be the same thing. And it's not. One's by position, even if the NBA is going to mess with those positions, and the other one's not. All NBA is about outstanding. Who are the most outstanding players? MVP is fundamentally different because of that word valuable. And so games played matters more. Second thing to me is this. It's LeBron freaking James. If I'm going to ever create an exception on the All NBA team, again, not for MVP, but with All NBA, am I going to go the extra mile to make sure that the best player of his generation, who was having an outstanding and MVP caliber type statistical year, that he makes it on because it doesn't make sense not to have him on? Yeah, I think that's fully justified. Dude is averaging 25, nearly 8 assists and nearly 8 rebounds. On the usual high-efficiency shooting. He is still a dominant player when he's out there, and as soon as somebody says, yeah, but he's missed too many games, this is what I'm going to say. He's played 43. The Lakers, as you and I speak, have, I think, 4 or 5 games left. So he's going to get into the high 40s. I did some research, because this is what I do, because I'm a freaking dork. But I think I think historical precedent matters, so I looked it up. Since the merger, fewest games to make All NBA, and this is in an 82-game season, not a 72-game season, so you got to do some adjusting. Scottie Pippen made third team 1 year, 97-98, with 44 out of 82. LeBron has played 43 out of 72 right now, and he's going to tack on another few games. So Pippen, 44. Yao Ming, in 2006-07, played 48 games, made the second team. Granted, lower bar for a center because there are not as many, especially then. Dennis Rodman, back in 94-95, made the third team by playing only 49 games. There are some guys who were in the 50-51 range. Pete Maravich, Steph Curry, Shaq, Dwayne Wade. All of these, and this is only 82-game seasons that I was looking at, not the lockout years where it's artificially low anyway. So if you look at those as percentages and you apply that to this season, LeBron's already in range. You know, Pippen makes third team with 54% of games played. LeBron is already at 43 games. He's already at like 60% of games played. So, like, there's no problem whatsoever on a historical basis to say LeBron should still make it. Now, if you want to downgrade him from first team because of not enough games and you want to say that Giannis and Kawhi or somebody else are more valuable because of that, fine. But I don't...
Well, this is... Hold on.
I'm not leaving him off entirely. He's got to be on one... He's got to be on one of them.
But, like, but are you... Is LeBron James on your ballot? I know you haven't filled it out yet, and there's days to go.
Yeah.
But in your mind, is he first team All NBA?
I have not decided where I'm placing LeBron. I know for sure he will be on my ballot.
There's a possibility you're going to charge him something for missing as many games as he's missed. Because otherwise, he'd be first team. If he wasn't first team...
Right.
That's because you've charged him something for games missed. So then it becomes down to what are you going to be charging him? Like, in your mind, you charge him 2 spots down to the third team All NBA. In that situation, I think it's justifiable to say, I'm going to leave him off because I've charged him a little bit more. And
you're opening my eyes
a little bit, because I thought a lot of people would just leave LeBron off just because of the number of games that he's missed. But
I will make this prediction. I will make this prediction. Out of 100 voters, there are going to be, I don't know how the numbers will break down. I think there's going to be a substantial amount of people who still put him first team. I think a substantial number who leave him off entirely, and then a bunch of people in between who put him on second or third team. We will see.
Why do you differentiate between games missed costing someone on your MVP ballot versus games missed costing someone on your All NBA ballot?
One, MVP is a higher honor, the highest honor that there is in the regular season. So the standards should be as high as possible. Two, because it is specifically the most valuable player. This isn't the most valuable top 15 players or the most valuable All NBA or what. It's just All NBA. And so, granted, we do not get definitions from the NBA on any of these ballots, right? None of them have any real definition attached. So it's all eye of the beholder.
And believe
stuff.
Me, I've asked. I'm sure you have. I've asked for clarity on a lot of these awards in the past.
Clarity would then lead to less debate, and less debate would lead to less engagement from fans and social media and stuff. So they would rather have us debate. I believe in having some consistency about it, though. So people can disagree about what definitions any of us apply or how we view what these awards mean. I just think that each of us has to do it consistent to our own standards. And I'm going to be consistent to my own standards. And my standard is MVP, games played and games missed matters more because it is the most valuable player. And value includes playing as many games as possible. So does Jokic have an advantage in part over Embiid because Embiid missed a third of the season? Yes, that is part of the case for Jokic over Embiid. It's not the entire case, but it is a significant part of it. And it's a reason why LeBron will not be on my MVP ballot at all when he was, I agree, the leader at the time that he first went down. All NBA is different. It is simply the most outstanding at their positions for the season. And I don't think games missed is as big of a deal there. It's not inconsequential. If LeBron had missed 60 games and played only 12, yeah, now I'm leaving him off. Like there, like somewhere there's like, and that's the eye of the beholder stuff, right? Where's the cutoff? Where's the cutoff that says, okay, lower a guy a notch or two, second team instead of first, third team instead of second, versus knocking him off entirely? LeBron having played 43, and by the time it's over, we'll have played maybe 46, 47, 48. Out of 72 games is enough. Given the importance of LeBron James to that team, to the league, to the fact that he still is, when he's playing, I think the best player in the NBA, then I'm not going to leave him off based on missing the percentage that he did. If it were a larger percentage, I'd have to reevaluate it. But again, I told you the historical standards there I looked at. It would not be at all unprecedented or out of turn to say that he should still be there based on what we've seen in the past.
Interesting, because your criteria, I just feel like you should put him first team. Like if he has played enough games to, in your mind, make an all NBA team, then based on what you've just said, I feel like he should be first team all NBA. Like he should be considered, because when he's healthy, he is first team all NBA, unquestionably.
Sure. Yeah. And I might still put him there. I haven't ruled that out. My first inclination is to lower him a notch, but dude, it's a sliding scale. Let's just acknowledge that everything is kind of a sliding scale. It's like with MVP. The vast majority of MVPs for the last 40 years have been on teams that won 50 plus games or the equivalent in a shortened season and had outstanding individual stats. Steve Nash won back-to-back MVPs without the gaudy stats of what we saw from, say, Giannis last year, or LeBron the years that he won it, or Steph Curry the year that he won it, or Kevin Durant the year that he won it. Steve Nash's stats do not measure up to all those guys. But it's a sliding scale. The Suns were so off the charts amazing, and he had done so much to completely transform that team that the voters, not me at that time, rewarded Steve Nash twice. So it's a sliding scale between the team performance and the individual stats. Just like there's a sliding scale for this. How many games missed is too many to keep him on the ballot, take him off the ballot, first team versus second team versus third team. It's a feel thing, right? And, you know, look, the one thing I do know, Giannis is first team all NBA forward. The second all NBA forward, I don't know. LeBron will definitely be on my ballot somewhere. That part I still have to figure out. And, you know, look, there's, as we'll get into, a lot of other really quality forwards that make this difficult.
Yeah, I think you're right, though. These ballots are going to be all over the place. There will be some with LeBron first team. There'll be some with LeBron third team. And there'll be some people that leave LeBron off entirely. It's going to be a hotly disputed award season in general. I'm thinking everybody should just turn their mentions off when these awards, when you release the names
forever.
Of the awards. Forever.
Yeah.
While we're talking about statistics and putting things into context, Russell Westbrook tied Oscar Robertson for the most triple-doubles in NBA history, 181 triple-doubles, and that's a record Westbrook is going to eventually cruise by and, you know, probably put himself up there as almost untouchable in triple-double era. He's going to average triple-double for the fourth straight season this year. How do you view that accomplishment, Howard, for Russell Westbrook? Because there probably has never been, at least in the modern era, a more polarizing player. I mean, some people see Russell Westbrook as the ultimate gamer that don't think his numbers are as valued as they should be. There are others that think the triple-double is now overvalued. It's become empty calories in a way. Everyone can do it, and that Westbrook is more of a stat stuffer than he is a winning player. How do you see Russell Westbrook?
In the interest of, again, trying to become a better marketer, people should go read our colleague Alex Pruitt's story about the triple-double that was in SI print and electronic versions recently, because the triple-double happens so much more now. Even if you took Westbrook out of it, there are so many more triple-doubles now than there were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for it. Alex Pruitt's story does a phenomenal job of explaining a lot of that. So to some extent, the triple-doubles that Westbrook gets now may not be the same as, say, the ones we saw Jason Kidd getting a generation ago because of the pace of the game, because of the way players are used. But you cannot cheapen or in any way degrade the accomplishment itself, because as Westbrook said, if it were that easy, you know, a lot more guys would be doing it. And more guys are doing it, but just not as often as he is, as consistently as he is. So what he's doing is truly special. What he's doing is truly astounding and amazing. But it's also, you know, look, I think we can have two separate discussions here, Chris. We can enjoy what Westbrook and be impressed by what Westbrook does and have just the athletic feat of it all, right? The energy level it takes, the dedication to it that it takes, the all-out effort that he always has every night, the fact that he's a great scorer and a passer and rebounding from that position, not even as a particularly big guard height-wise. Like, all of that's impressive. We can appreciate that and still debate, whether in the present or after his career is over, whether Westbrook channeled all of that into winning, right? Because Durant leaves, first-round loss for a Westbrook-led Thunder team. Paul George and Carmelo arrive, another first-round loss. He goes to Houston, where he wanted to be with his buddy Harden. They need 7 games to get rid of a depleted Oklahoma team that's now got Chris Paul instead. And then they get to the second round and get knocked out pretty easily. So, yeah, is it channeling into winning? Lately, what we've seen with the Wizards is I think they've won 15 of their last 19. So, yes, his triple-doubles do lead to winning, but that team is still going to be scrapping to get into the play-in. Granted, a lot of shit happened to them this season that has nothing to do with Westbrook, but still, they're probably an 8th seed and a first round out at best. And so we can have 2 separate discussions. We can both appreciate Westbrook and praise what he's been able to do at a level that no one else has done in the history of the game and appreciate that for what it is. And we can still debate the fact that he's never been a particularly efficient scorer and he turns the ball over a lot and doesn't really defend at a high level. Those are all fair.
Look, I believe, and I've long believed, that Russell Westbrook is a winner. You know, everything, if you look at Westbrook's career just from 10,000 feet, it's easy to say he doesn't win games. Because you're right, he has bowed out in the first round a couple of times with Oklahoma City. You can certainly argue that last year with Paul George was an underachieving team. They should have beaten the Portland Trailblazers in that playoff series. But last year in the bubble, yes, it took them 7 games to get past Oklahoma City, and they were beaten pretty handily by the Lakers in the second round. But Westbrook was dealing with a leg injury that still bothered him when he got to training camp with the Washington Wizards. Like, it was still an issue, a lingering issue, several months later in Washington. And getting beat in the first round in the year after losing Durant, to me, it's a miracle that team got to the playoffs. Like, the history, Howard, of teams that lose a star on the level of Durant is bad.
Because most of them didn't have 3 stars to begin with or a backup star like Westbrook. Westbrook was already a star. We knew that. Usually if you lose a player of that caliber, you have nobody else who could step in. So, and by the way, and I'll point this out for the rest of time, the Thunder won, I think it was 47 games, which was right in the range of what all the odds makers had them at and all the preseason algorithms had them at before that season. They did not overachieve. They exactly achieved.
I mean, okay, but like, let's not act like that Thunder team was loaded with talent that should have won them a first round series. Like, I'm not here for that. Like, that
they lost the second year when they had Paul George. You know, I mean,
that
I
one
just,
is look, on him. That look, that one, that's there. Yeah,
It can't always be Steven Adams' fault or Paul George's fault or Carmelo's fault or Harden's fault or somebody else. Like, at some point, we have to be able to look at, you know, you talk about the 10,000-foot view. Well, the 10,000-foot view would also be like, oh, look at these amazing stats. And you could get carried away in that direction, too, and overjudge just what the stats mean. It's not that they're meaningless, but we have to weigh both the stats and the lack of postseason success sans Durant. And like all of that matters. Like all of that is relevant to the discussion, I think. And it's not that Westbrook's flaws haven't always been there and been apparent. Defense, efficiency in shooting the ball, taking way too many threes for a guy who can't shoot the three worth a damn. You know, the audaciousness of him is what makes him so fascinating and fun to watch as a player, but it's also what's maddening. If you're rooting for him to win and he's jacking up some of those threes or the long twos at critical moments of fourth quarters, as he often did, and missing them, like, those are fair things to judge him on. And it's not the totality of why he lost these postseason series, but he's a big part of it. He's the most important player on his team. We always judge the most important player on the team based on their postseason win-loss. It comes with it.
In the three-point era, Russell Westbrook is probably the best worst three-point shooter player ever. For a guy that can't shoot the three, he's the best player among that group. If you take a group of players that are terrible at shooting three, Russell Westbrook is probably the best in that group. And the numbers he puts up are startling.
I think he's also, I'm pretty sure this is the case because people have run this stat before. I haven't looked it up recently. But I think if you take the highest volume three-point shooters in the league over the last, whatever, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, he's got by far the worst shooting percentage of everybody who's taken at least X amount. I can't remember what that plateau is. But yeah, he which it indicates that he takes way too many of them. And part of being a good player, a great player, is knowing, you know, when to shoot and when not to, being more judicious with your usage. And that is a fault of his. It's not unfair to criticize him for that.
You know, for as hard as that guy works, and he clearly works really hard, it's almost remarkable he hasn't become a better three-point shooter. Like, his form's not terrible. Like, it's not some awkward, screwed-up form.
Yeah.
Be surprised. Surprising, really, that he hasn't developed that part of his game. This season, though, Westbrook is contributing to winning. You mentioned, all the bullshit that, you know, Washington's had to go through. Two weeks without, you know, with COVID-related issues. They come back, can barely practice. They get beat up in the first 4 or 5 games. Now they're streaking, and they're in a good position to make the playoffs. So I think, regardless of what happens this season, I think this is a positive year for Westbrook with the Wizards. I don't think it's looked at as they got Russell Westbrook, they didn't miss the playoffs. No. So many other things happened to this team early on that snake bit this season. But if they do get into the playoffs, in the regular playoff field beyond the play-in game, who the hell wants to play that team? You really want to play Westbrook and Bradley Beal, who can give you 60 on any given night? That team full of three-point shooters, that team whose defense has been a lot better since Daniel Gafford came on board and fortified that front court off the bench. I'm not saying they beat, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, or Brooklyn, but those three teams, they're probably looking at other teams in that field they'd rather play than the Washington Wizards.
No question. Assuming the Wizards, and I think they will, they're definitely in the play-in. If they do end up with that eighth seed, which I think is pretty good shot, they won't be the average eighth seed by any stretch. And given what their record will have been, I think it's as we speak, I think it's 15-4 since April 5th. So a little bit more season to go here, and then the play-in games. Their record over that span is going to far outstrip probably what any eighth seed has normally done in that same, 25 games toward the end of a season. They will not be the average eighth seed. It's one of the most potent backcourts in the league. It's a team that we all thought was going to be a lot better when the season began, but yes, COVID, injuries, Thomas Bryant going down, Westbrook still trying to get himself back right, all those things contributed to them being where they'll end up. But yeah, I think Philly's going to end up probably with the number one seed. I don't think they want to see Washington in the first round. And I'm not saying the Wizards are going to pull off, one of the rare 8-1 upsets, but they're going to give them everything they can handle. It's going to be a hell of a series. It's going to be a blast to watch. And look, just to get back to, what does it all mean for Westbrook's legacy and all this stuff? I'm less concerned with whether Westbrook averages a triple-double again and that he's catching Oscar Robertson and all this other stuff. It's all great for the history books. But I think ultimately, because we have to judge both pieces of it, I think we should judge the fact that he revived this team. And Beal's part of that too. But if Westbrook doesn't do what he's doing for the last month and a half, we're not even talking about them as a play-in team or possibly one of the greatest eighth seeds we've ever seen. So to bring this back around to Westbrook, I think this is one of his more impressive accomplishments. I know that everybody looks at the year without Durant, as you bring up, and he wins MVP that year and was recognized for it. But I think this is right up there with one of those, you know, feathers in his cap to have revived a team that I think we all kind of left for dead 2 months ago.
Yeah, I agree. The season will be over. The regular season will be over by the time we record again this time next week. So over these next 6-7 days, as the regular season wraps up, tell me something you're watching. Tell me what the most interesting part of the final week of the season is going to be.
It goes back to our discussion with Bill Orem at the top, really. Like, you know, this league has revolved around LeBron James for a long time. It's revolved around the Lakers for literally decades. It seems like centuries. So whatever the Lakers do and whatever LeBron does is always going to be top of the list. And besides that, they're defending champs, and they've had a really strange few months here with Anthony Davis out, LeBron out, bringing in Drummond, trying to incorporate him, lose Schroeder to COVID. Like, LeBron maybe coming back as soon as Tuesday night? Is the number of games they have with him and AD back in the lineup and Drummond, is that enough to get them all in rhythm? Is how close to 100% is LeBron going to be? When is Schroeder coming back? Since he probably does, in fact, have the virus, how long is it going to take him to get back to full strength? So everything about this last week, I'm looking for, like, where do the Lakers, what do they look like, and where do they end up in the final standings? Because they certainly look like they're slotted for the play-in, the one place they never wanted to be.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Lakers. I'm looking at the Nets to see if James Harden comes back and how many games they can get to play together. But I'm also looking at Boston. Like, the Celtics stink, Howard. Like, I don't know what's going on with them, but they look like the 2018 Celtics, that dysfunctional bunch. Now, that group didn't really like each other. Like, that was not a team of friends. I mean, the Kyrie dynamic shook things up that year. This team, I don't think there's a bad locker room, but they're just not good, and they play with no energy. They got tattooed by Miami on Sunday. And the MO of the Celtics for most of the second half of the season is you fall behind by 30, you rally, and you lose by like 8. Like, that's kind of their thing. Miami comes in to Boston for the first of a 2-game set. The second one is on Tuesday. And Miami understands the urgency of that situation. Like, they understand the importance of winning, getting the 6th seed, and avoiding the play-in. Celtics kind of collectively shrugged. They're like, game doesn't feel that important to me. They didn't play with anywhere near the type of urgency that you need to have. Now, theoretically, they could fall to number 8. Like, they could, Charlotte could jump them in the standings. Only 2 games up on the Hornets as we record this in the loss column. So I'm kind of curious to see what kind of energy the Celtics have in this final week, because I feel like this is like deja vu. I'm saying this from 2018. They've got the talent to win a first-round series. Like, when Robert Williams is healthy, Tatum and Brown are healthy, Kemba's healthy, they're potent offensively. They've historically been a good defensive team, so that mindset is there. If they put their stuff together, they can be okay. But there's been like 2-week stretches where they don't play with any type of urgency or any type of energy. So I guess I'm wondering if they go into the playoffs with any type of momentum, or does this slide continue where we see them get into the play-in tournament and worse, lose in the play-in tournament and wind up out of the playoffs, which, by the way, not outside the realm of possibility.
Not at all, given that they're completely unpredictable. They've got to be, I mean, there are plenty of disappointments as there are every year. You can look around and identify a few teams that are like the frustrating, disappointing teams of the year. The Celtics might be the most frustrating team of the entire season and the biggest underachievers at this stage.
Yeah.
And like a lot of teams, you know, there are reasons. You know, we can point to Jason Tatum going down with COVID in January and the long road back for him. We could point to Marcus Smart being out with an injury for a long stretch. We could point to Kemba Walker missing the first month plus of the season with the knee and him having to work his way back into shape. Like, we can point to stuff, but, and now, you know, Jaylen Brown more recently being hurt. Like, okay, but this is a team that has been perennially in the contender to pseudo contender category. And this is far from that. And other teams have gone through stuff too. And here we are, you know, jacked up about how amazing the Wizards have been and could they be this really dangerous first round opponent as an 8th seed. Like, the Celtics are still above them in the standings, but there's less, I think, less faith, less positivity, less intrigue about what the Celtics can do in the playoffs than the Wizards. And that has everything to do with how they're playing right now and the momentum that you either have or do not in the case of the Celtics. So I don't know what to make of it, Chris. There's been a talent drain the last several years, you know, losing Gordon Hayward, losing Terry Rozier for that matter. The Kyrie for Kemba swap hasn't worked out quite as well as they would have hoped. Maybe the chemistry issues from a couple of years ago weren't just about Kyrie. Maybe there's more going on there than meets the eye. I don't know what to make of it. I've always loved the idea of a Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown foundation, having two really versatile wings in today's NBA, two guys who can do just about everything at both ends. But something's still amiss with this team. And if they don't make it out of the plane, and I think that's on the table, as you said, I wonder what the consequences for that are.
Yeah, I don't think you do anything substantial, at least not with your core, with that team. Not in a weird season. You know, I think if this had happened during a traditional 82-game season, you might have more of a reaction. I think in the offseason, regardless of what happens in these playoffs, you go in and you look to upgrade. Maybe you try to find more help at point guard. I think you need to add another big to that mix, someone with a little more physicality to complement a Rob Williams. But I don't think you shake things up. But this is going to go down as an equally disappointing season to what 2018 won. 2018, there were championship hopes to start the season. You had Hayward and Irving rejoining a team that went to the conference finals and came within one game of knocking off Cleveland. You thought the addition of those two players would make Boston championship contender. That didn't work. This season didn't have championship aspirations, but certainly you expect them to be competing for a top three spot in the Eastern Conference, and that just hasn't happened. So, Howard, we look forward to your mystery guest on Friday, whoever that may be. And I'd like to say first, I'd like to be the first to verbally tweet you that your ballot sucks, and congratulations. It's terrible.
It will be the first of many. Dozens, maybe. Hundreds? We'll see.